Welcome to MacGuffin Men. I'm Alex, and with me as usual is James. You can check out our website, themacguffinmen.com, to keep up with our most recent podcasts. Last week we talked about Seconds, the 1966 John Frankenheimer film. Prior to that was A Serious Man, 2009 Coen Brothers film. Before that was Le Samurai, year I'm forgetting, Melville film. And Hard Day's Night before that, Punch Drunk Love before that, and I will mention it because it's slightly pertinent to today's conversation, Stalker was before that. So that's themacguffinmen.com, and yeah, check it out.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. And now, here are Alex and James.
James.
Mm-hmm.
Here we are.
Yep. Talking some Tarkovsky relevant movies.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, we're talking about Annihilation today.
Yes.
Which I assume you're talking about The Zone, Stalker.
Yeah, The Zone, and also just a movie of people, a small group of people walking slowly in the direction of something that they're kind of afraid of.
Yeah, it's a journey movie, kind of broadly.
Yeah, yeah. But this gives, this is going to sound weird to say, but this movie gives you more answers than Stalker does.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I kind of feel, I don't know. I feel like this wants to be more like that and wasn't. I mean, I understand why it could go all the way there in terms of pace and stuff like that. But I think I needed more of that than less, to be honest.
More of
Stalker and kind of that very vague feeling.
Yeah, yeah, I could have dealt with that, but it's also, I don't know. It's a different movie, because about halfway through the movie I'm like, oh, this is like Stalker, and then I was just like, oh, I need to stop myself from comparing this to Stalker because that's unfair, you know.
Yeah,
and it's not like Stalker is the only comparison point for this movie. I mean, it's not the only Tarkovsky movie you can compare it to. It's very reminiscent of Solaris as well, just in the construction of Lena's storyline. But yeah, I don't know, it's own beast.
Yeah, and what did you like it, or where are you with it?
After the first time I saw it, I was kind of just like, I could go either way. I will say immediately, a sci-fi movie with a climax that's like a 10-minute interpretive dance sequence, like, sign me up 10 times out of 10. So that I was immediately on board for and very excited about. But walking out of the movie, I could have been like, I could see my opinion going either way over time. And I do recognize I tend to give movies the benefit of the doubt in general. It doesn't matter who the director is, like, because it's just more fun to like a movie than to hate a movie.
Yeah.
And but then I saw it again and I was like, nope, this is a really, really good movie. And I like it a lot.
Okay.
Yeah, because some of the things that I felt bothered me a little bit the first time I saw it really, really fell away the second time I saw it.
Okay, such as?
Specifically Garland's directorial style, which is not perfect, you know, like, he really does feel like a writer directing a movie still. And, I mean, we talked about this with Martin McDonagh and Three Billboards. That's not necessarily bad, you know, because there are certain things about that lead to sort of a protecting of words, over visuals. And, but just in the way that I gravitate towards film, like a really stark visual or really strong visual style will be something that makes me happier than a really good script. And I think you are the opposite, which is, I think, sort of what led to, I think, you liking something like Three Billboards slightly more than I did, specifically because the visuals, visual detractions of that movie didn't hurt you like they did for me. But as I sort of, when I was watching Annihilation again, I realized that something that's cool about Garland's directorial style is specifically that nothing about it is flashy, which on a second viewing allows you to sort of start to see some of the more subtle things that exist within that style and don't detract from the actual script in any way and just sort of augment it in a way that's really interesting. And and doesn't spoon feed you at all. And I thought that was really cool.
Yeah. So, since you had sort of a different opinions, I guess, between seeing it once and seeing it twice, that do you think it will split a lot of people, and you've just managed to kind of jump over that split, or how do you think that'll work?
I think it's so weird that over time it's going to be accepted positively.
It feels inevitable, eh?
Yeah, especially since, I just think of the way that I will sometimes go back to a movie that's 15 years old that I watched at the time and didn't, like, embrace how bizarre it was in the filmmaking climate. I'm blanking on something that could be an example for it, but I wish I had thought about something, but, like, I can really easily imagine myself watching this movie for the first time in a number of years in 2032 or something, and just being like, how did this get made in early 2018 at a major studio, you know? And those are also questions that are being asked currently. Those questions only get stronger and stronger as time goes on. We're not going to get to a point 14, 15 years from now where suddenly studios are making movies like Annihilation every 6 months. You know, that's just never going to happen. So when something sticks out as an outlier, and I think this movie sticks out as an outlier in ways and keeps itself very, very consciously vague, that it allows the viewer to project a lot onto it. I could just see people gravitating to it over time. And it's just going to be one of those movies where not a lot of people have seen it, you know, relatively speaking. But a small group of people that do like this movie like it a lot. You know, Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Robert Ford is probably a good example of that, in that it actually has like a repertory sort of project that goes around America trying to screen that movie, you know. And that's a movie that was, I think, filmed in 2005, released in 2007 by Warner Brothers, and at the time was only kind of an outlier, but the further we get away from it, we're like, how did a studio make this movie?
Yeah, and that's another one that's another movie that has a lot of room to breathe in it. And I think you mean that those are more likely to be looked favorably upon because it's not so packed, so it's not so dated in a way. Not that it's necessarily a depiction of that moment in time, but just having those ambiguities and those, like, that amount of space to bring your own thoughts to it. I mean, that space it's empty, so it'll age better, you know what I mean?
Yep, absolutely. And I mean, the textbook example for this is a movie like Blade Runner, the first Blade Runner movie, where the people that saw it and liked it immediately, it sort of stuck with them, mostly for production design reasons, and over time it became a classic film, you know? And I'm not saying Annihilation will be, but I'm saying I can see a life cycle very similar to that, at a smaller level, of course, but...
Yeah, and this sounds weird, but kind of devoid of quality. I think it had this instant cult classic kind of vibe to it, right? But having that space and taking chances and having a very distinct visual style throughout it.
Yeah, for sure. I am curious to know where you come down on the critical fence, or which side of the critical fence you come down on.
Yeah, I mean... If it's a fence thing, that it's kind of, did this work or did it not work? And it's a dichotomy like that. I'm going to say it doesn't work. Yep. And I love the, I don't know. I think that this movie on paper, I ate so many things that I want. And maybe that was part of it, that my hopes were too high, probably because of how much I enjoyed Ex Machina. And then I didn't know much about the source material, obviously, and didn't kind of pay too much attention to what this movie was going to look like. I just kind of knew I was on board already. And I think all the pieces are there, and it just never feels cohesive to me. And maybe that's, as we said, it's this movie that has some space to breathe, and it is kind of wide open like that. So maybe those things are getting crossed for me, but I don't see the movie that everybody seems to really love in here.
Yep. I can't say that surprises me. That was sort of my projected opinion of how you would feel about this movie.
Yeah, and then, I mean, every few times something will happen, and, I mean, there's visually some things that I really, really like, and even not just visually, but in the plot, there are some things that, again, on paper, I really enjoy. Just, I just never feel like it comes together. And the CGI of the actual, animals or creatures, I think, and I'm not someone who usually sticks on this or kind of one of my other main criticisms of it, but that those moments don't really ring true to me. And I think that this movie definitely isn't just an action movie, that the set pieces like that need to be good. But I think that that's part of what I think glares about this movie to me.
Yep. I too have complained a little bit about that, but I don't know. A lot of it for me was the stuff that bothered me visually was mostly like in that scene in Ventress's office where Lena and Ventress are talking about the shimmer. And it's just like, they're just shooting an office scene and there's just clearly a giant green screen right behind them, you know, like that type of stuff bothers me more than actual creatures. Cause I never really find creatures like that. CGI creatures look realistic, you know? I suppose with the exception of the Revenant bear, which may or may not have been CGI, but, I don't know. It's more usually when an environment is CGI is when I have more problems with it. And that scene is a perfect example of that.
Yeah. And I think that, that's kind of things like that, not necessarily CGI only, but I just felt a little bit distant from this movie at all times. Like there's definitely moments that were engaging, but overall it never felt kind of immediate and fully present for me. And I think, the performances are mostly good. There's a couple, there's a speech on the canoe there between Natalie Portman and, what's her name?
I don't remember her name.
Okay. Yeah. why am I asking you? You never remember the names.
Lena, Anya, Ventress, Kane, Tessa Thompson. Bunch of names.
Right. Yeah. I found that a couple scenes like that kind of need to emotionally anchor things for me, also missed. And some of the, I'd say the same way about Natalie Portman and Oscar Isaac together on screen, who people I enjoy very much separately. I found any of their stuff together to be a big miss as well. And I kind of needed that. There's just so many things like that I needed to work that didn't quite work for me.
Okay. I've also seen those complaints, as well. I mean, I don't like, Natalie Portman sleepwalking is still better than most actors, but I feel like Natalie Portman sleepwalking in this movie. That's a bigger conversation about our feelings on Natalie Portman's skill level. I do feel that, I've seen that complaint about, the backstory doesn't give you enough to care about these characters or something about their interactions. There's nothing there. Like we literally see one tickle fight and they were like, oh, they're in love, you know, like, and I think a very easy thing to say about the two films Garland has directed, this one and Ex Machina, is that they're just cold films. And that there's just not a lot of emotion in them. And this movie actually relies on there being emotion. Staunch supporter of Mr. Steven Soderbergh, I'm used to very emotionally cold films, and I just don't. I don't know. If you give me a totem of, oh, okay, these people had a tickle fight, and now I'm supposed to believe that they love each other. Cool, you know, like that's enough for me. I'll just give you that, you know, because I don't want to watch scenes of them in a relationship just painting the house together or something, you know. So I'd rather have like a brisk, kind of like shitty exposition of them loving each other more than 20 minutes of setup of Oscar Isaac and Natalie Portman going down to the farmer's market, you know, just holding hands.
Yeah, no, I get that. And that's what I mean. There are times when we get further away from the stuff that I don't think works. And when it strings together, as I said, it's not that I dislike the performances, and obviously so much of the, like just the setting, the set design, the production design, just everything. It makes for some really great visuals. And as we said, kind of something that you can see people liking more and more, or at least holding up, just some very striking imagery throughout this movie that you know, it starts winning me over at those times, but then I find myself losing it too quickly. But yeah, I'm not trying to couch everything I'm saying and that I didn't enjoy it, but because there are definitely things that had me kind of going back and forth on that side of the fence. Mm-hmm. But I think if I had to have landed somewhere, it was there.
Yeah, yeah. No, we don't really deal in binaries. We're not Rotten yeah. Tomatoes. So, you know, it's not like I'm fully on the other side of the fence. It's just I'm definitely more on the other side of the fence. What you were saying about the look of the movie and stuff like some of that CGI that we talked about, I just want to point out that a lot of times, I mean, we're talking about this movie less than a week after it was released. And movie theaters that we are going to see this movie are projecting on like really shitty DC digital projections. And since this movie was shot digitally, that combination of things, it will always look better at home. So I think like a lot of my visual problems, especially as somebody like myself who likes to sit like really close to the screen, and you can just straight up see pixels sometimes in these projections at Cineplex. Anti shout out to Cineplex. And then you watch it at home like 8 months later, and you know, it's just on a smaller screen, and those things don't jump out at you as much. So I think that's part of that's going to help it age well as well as that. I think some of those visual things will fall away. Yeah. And also, like you said, there are some really fantastic visual things in this movie. I think all of the combination of like the purple, green, and blue of the shimmer, and just the way that it's sort of sprinkled in the background throughout exterior scenes in the shimmer is fantastic. I figure you got a kick out of the trunk shot in this movie that comes from inside of the alligator. Basically everything once you get to the lighthouse is visually stunning. So, you know, there's lots of good stuff in these movies, but when we're talking about special effects, the bad stuff always jumps out first, you know?
Yeah, and when we discussing The Last Jedi, you and I, you know, we said movies that we don't necessarily like, or scenes that we don't necessarily like, you still see those images that kind of strike you, and you're like, yeah, okay, that'll be in the Oscar montage, mm-hmm. you know, for visual effects or something. Like, there's just some really nice striking images that come out of this movie, and I think that the people having turned into flowers, and I'm still at a loss for words for a lot of what's in this movie, but that creature we see at the bottom of the pool with all the colors kind of spilling outward, mm-hmm. Just some very, very, just as I said, some imagery that really sticks with you, and could be in its repertoire of iconic things about this movie.
Yeah. Yep, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just saying, while looking at my notes and trying to figure out where to go from there.
Okay.
Yeah. I suppose that's something that this movie has in common with Tarkovsky, is I feel like there are going to be a lot of while we look at our notes. So I'm trying to figure out what we're going to talk about next. So one of the things I enjoyed about the movie, and specifically Garland's, some of that directorial stuff I was talking about, and I feel like I recall this being present in Ex Machina in some capacity. I don't remember too much in detail because I haven't seen that movie since we did a podcast about it. But I find the way that the movie uses lines to divide characters was really interesting. It feels like a lot of movies have been doing this recently. Like, it might be sort of just a trend in directorial choices. And also just, it's one of the fundamental rules of framing an image is to use lines to your advantage. But I found Lena, especially in the beginning, is really framed by herself, by either door frames or just the lines behind her in that interview scene with where Benedict Wong is interviewing her. She's framed by herself, and then we get the reverse shot of Benedict Wong, and it's a low angle looking up at him, and he's also framed in these lines that are on the wall, but there's also somebody else in the frame with him, just to the right. And then you go to Lena in school, and she's teaching her class. She's surrounded by people, but behind her is a window, and she is just framed by the frame of this window. It's like a glass wall, but you can clearly see the lines, you know, holding glass together. It's not just one giant pane sort of thing. And I thought that was really cool. And we get lots of further examples of that in the house as well. You know, we've got Lena painting. She's framed in the doorway of the bedroom. And then Kane comes in through that doorway, and we see him by himself in that doorway. And then we cut to them together in that doorway. And I just thought that the way the movie draws lines between human beings and sort of shows the barriers between them is really cool. And I think my favorite example of that is, I suppose outside of the ending, is the video where Kane cuts open his fellow soldier, and we see the intestine snake situation, whatever we're going to call that. And everybody's very disturbed by this video, rightfully so. All five of the women walk in different directions. And when we get into that wide shot, they're all framed by a different portion of the wall. And each of the colors is different. Like, I remember, I feel like it's Tessa Thompson's character, who is like the one character's name I can't remember, apparently. She goes out into, which it's kind of an exterior. It's more like a window, or sorry, like the window's been broken. Anya's in front of another window. Lena has knelt down in front of another one because she's very disturbed by what she just saw her husband do. And then Ventress is walking off screen, but still framed underneath a different panel. And I just thought, and like, I'm doing a terrible job describing that. But if you saw the movie again, you'd be like, oh yeah, that is exactly right. And that shot is really cool because, I mean, a lot of these people, I suppose mostly three people in Ventress are at odds, and then Lena's sort of in the middle. But when something like that happens, you kind of just immediately, or you see something like that, they were just immediately divided. And I thought the way that the movie showed them from each looking over each other's shoulder to watch this video into people that are just in five distinctly different locations, I thought that was a really cool way to show them breaking apart, if only temporarily, you know, although yeah. It's not like they're ever that together ever again in the movie, now that I think about it.
Yeah. And obviously isolation is a big theme in this movie. So to have them framed like that, where they're, you know, they're isolated from themselves, but in the greater story of this, they are very much isolated from the rest of the world, you know, being in the Shimmer and being the only people that they know are alive in there. So to use that visual move often, I think, lines up thematically as well.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And just the overall structure of this movie. I mean, we have this idea of the Shimmer as a big theme in this, and the way it distorts and refracts. And they use that as, you know, to inform the structure of the film by mixing in flashbacks and, you know, constantly keeping you in a state where you're not sure where you are temporally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you always kind of have a pretty decent idea. Anytime there's a flashback, like, they make it pretty clear. The interview, the first thing that we see, is pretty clearly very towards the end of the chronology of the film. Also, we saw all those movies in the 90s that used that technique, so like, we're well versed in it. You know, all the flashback sequences, you generally know where they fall in. There's only a couple. It's basically like you have to judge them by Kane's emotional reaction as to where they they fall temporarily. But even then, they all feel like they're pretty close together, and it's just he's still working some stuff out in his own head. Yeah.
Yeah. And they kind of build towards that more chaotic structure. We get the, that shot of their hands through the glass of water early on, just kind of this little, that notion of distortion and separation coming in, through a small little visual key before that movie really, takes off and gets as weird as it does.
Yeah. I mean, I almost high-fived people first time I saw this movie and I saw that shot. I was just like, because, you know, the first time you see it, it's just Kane's hand. And, you know, he's just come home and it's clear that they're having a hard time talking to each other. Despite the fact that, again, we would expect this to be a very celebratory scene. And we see Lena reach over to him, and just the way that the hands are distorted, because, like, what's a signifier of a couple? I mean, earlier when I made a joke about them going to a farmer's market together, I joked about them holding hands. And we just can't, like, they're holding hands, but it just doesn't look like two human beings holding hands. And I immediately was very excited about that shot because it's fantastic. And of course, she pulls her hand away further, you know, adding more to that point, you know, just good work, Garland.
Yeah. And the idea that he's still in that distorted place, or at least feeling the effects of it, that his hand's still in there for a bit before or after she pulls her hand away.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And then he starts bleeding in the water and everything, everything goes crazy.
Yeah. And I thought the ambulance abduction there, was cool. And I mean, at that point, you still don't, you're not really sure of much of this story. It's just one of those things that's kind of, that's very arresting, and you're still piecing together what this is supposed to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. It's, you know, assuming that you haven't read the book, and even apparently the book or the movie takes a lot of changes from the book as well. So, you know, you're just kind of like, oh, why are they kidnapping Natalie Portman? She seems so nice, you know?
Yeah.
And yeah, it's just this is a movie built on the back of genre constructions that we know. And then it's just, you know, slowly moving itself away from genre constructions until again, we get to an extended interpretive dance at the climax of the film.
It's interesting for a sci-fi movie and what other sci-fi it gets compared to in reading reviews. I mean, we've talked about the first Blade Runner, and I think everything we said about that is true of the newer Blade Runner as well, you know, just some very arresting images and a lot of ambiguities and space to breathe. And we talked about Stalker, and just in kind of the more recent, I don't know if this is the right term, but intellectual sci-fi, we had Arrival and people really like that. And I see comparisons to that as well. And I mean, just to use the term intellectual, because that was something that came up in, I guess, how the studio felt that it was too intellectual in the history of this movie.
Yeah, I believe the word that has been used is cerebral in the studio.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
it's just looking at it in that continuum. How do you, like, what other movies do you think inform this? And what do you think of the kind of the newer, I mean, this has always been an element of sci-fi, obviously, but it seems the ones that have registered lately, other than Star Wars, which is a much different kind of sci-fi, is ones that people are saying are maybe too cerebral or too intellectual for people to enjoy, but then get reviewed positively.
Yeah. So, I mean, I've thought about this, and I think it's just because there's now, like, as time has progressed and digital effects have gotten better, it's made it, one, easier for people to make more science fiction movies, and two, it's made it easier for people to make those science fiction movies even more fantastical, because you can design basically anything in a computer now and have it look passable. So I think people in general have just become more accustomed to sci-fi, and if you look at the history of the genre on film, it's primarily is just really campy, like shitty stuff, with a few exceptions, you know. And it's like Metropolis is one of the most famous films of all time. It's a science fiction movie. I think that was made in like 1927 or something. And that's the only science fiction movie I can think of before the sound era began, you know. And I just sort of think it's been like a natural progression as filmmaking techniques have become more intricate, and people are able to do more things. And also then there's generations of people growing up watching science fiction movies that are done well and in ways that aren't cheesy. And they're like, oh, this can be something that stimulates my mind in a different way than, say, George Lucas watching Buck Rogers or Flash Gordon or whatever it was that influenced the original Star Wars. You know, you also have Ridley Scott watching something that, I guess Metropolis is a good example, because that was a clear influence on Blade Runner. Him watching something like Metropolis and being like, oh, okay, that science fiction can be for adults, you know, and then he goes and makes Alien and Blade Runner. And I just sort of think that has continued over time. And Alex Garland, I think he's in his mid to late 40s, certainly falls in line with a huge generation of filmmakers who are now You know, I mean, the person that made the most recent Star Wars movie, Rian Johnson, is in the same generation as Alex Garland. And they're people that saw Star Wars in a theater when they were 7 years old. And it's just always been a part of their cinematic language. And the same can be said for critics of their generation as well. And so I just sort of think it's been a maturing of the genre through mostly external factors, you know, just people getting used to the genre.
Yeah, that's a good point about the timing of Star Wars, actually, that I hadn't really considered, because it is a bit of a, I mean, I'm sure there's science fiction people or fans who are bigger science people who are bigger fans of science fiction than we are, but who would disagree. But yeah, I mean, for the most part, it is after that anything that's critically appreciated, well, not anything, that's probably not right, but most things that are critically appreciated don't fall into.
Yeah, exactly. And if, say, to use continue using Blade Runner as an example, it's 82, I think, when that movie comes out. You know, when if you're a 50-year-old film reviewer in 1982, Blade Runner is nothing like almost like anything that you grew up watching. You know, it's just it's a language that is totally different. And by the time you were a full-grown adult, that still isn't a language you have learned how to speak. And just the older you get, the harder it is to learn new things or cinematic languages, unless you're really open to those things, which some reviewers were at the time, but the most weren't. You know?
Yeah. So. Yeah, and yeah, I think it's a good point, as you said, that it's sort of at a time in the genre's story that it does get appreciated more easily by adults and people who take film seriously, because if the effects aren't there, it kind of does feel insulting to your intelligence. And if you can't buy into that, then you feel less likely to buy into the whole thing, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And so as a science fiction movie, I mean, it's science fiction-y in the sense that, you know, we have mutant creatures coming after you. You know, the ending feels very sci-fi, especially. And
yeah. I mean, it's very 2001. You know, it's just a different sort of version of the same thing.
Yeah, exactly. Which is so seminal in the genre. Mm-hmm. And just the kind of the fantasy sci-fi feeling that is anything taking place in the Shimmer, and the effects on the biology around them and the effects that it has on the world. Mm-hmm. But what do you think is sci-fi? I mean, thematically, what is this movie actually about that kind of aligns it with that genre, or what resonates here for you?
I think, I mean, to sort of find the thing that I like about science fiction, again, you brought up Star Wars as like a textbook example of a type of science fiction that we don't gravitate to as much. Like, you know, the two camps are basically Star Wars and Blade Runner, and we've said Blade Runner way more times than we've said Star Wars in this podcast because that's the type of people we are. Whereas, like, a lot of the really popular science fiction, or immediately popular science fiction, is sort of more journey-based because it's very influenced by Star Wars, and the vast majority of the Marvel movies are as well. You know, they're journey-based in some capacity, and very plot-driven. It's like, okay, we go here and we have this action scene, then we take this Infinity Stone over here, and then we have that action sequence, and then, oh, we find out that so-and-so is so-and-so's father. Okay, cool, now we have climactic action scene, and then we have the scene where we all shake hands and are excited to eat shawarma together or whatever.
When done properly, that's how it's supposed to be.
I just wrote the next 8 films in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Whereas something like Annihilation is... It's more like you just sort of have to attach yourself to something that, like, I don't know, you have to find something that's more of a concept that you want to think about in this film, and then just sort of attach yourself to how the movie shows something to do with that concept. And the thing that I found myself attaching my own projections to is just sort of the fact that everybody has something that makes them okay with going into this place that they probably won't come back from. You know, they have some sort of regret, or feel that maybe life isn't worth living anymore. And I think that's so dark. And especially since literally only one person has come back, and he starts bleeding into his own glass of water the second he does. I don't know. There's just a real, somebody's got to be either feeling some very dark things, or be really, really dedicated to exploration, to sort of go through these things. And, you know, we get that discussion on the boat that you had pointed out before with the character whose name neither of us can remember. Just how she talks about how her daughter died. Her daughter had leukemia and died. And we learned that Ventress has cancer, and, you know, seems like the type of person that just doesn't have much going on outside of looking for whatever the answer to this mystery is in the Shimmer. And it seems like Tessa Thompson's character is a little bit dissatisfied with her life. She's sort of got the that sort of like genius depression vibe to her, you know, like, because she's sold to us as the smartest person in the group, and somebody that cuts herself or whatever to quote unquote feel something. And then we've got Anya, who's struggling with addiction in some capacity, and all of those people are just like using these the Shimmer as a way to get rid of the things that they can't stop thinking about in the real world. You know, it's just something to help them hopefully eventually get past their own personal issues, but at least for the time being, help them avoid thinking about what they're dealing with. Yeah.
Yeah. And it is that kind of sense of dread that I think is beyond just the horror elements of this movie that is supposed to make this movie kind of heavy and have an emotional backbone to it. And yeah, at the start of that, I was thinking that we mentioned that it is such a straight, you know, in a way it is so linear that it's this journey movie that you start on the perimeter of the Shimmer and you go all the way into the lighthouse. Right. Mm-hmm. And I agree that this film isn't as kind of kaleidoscopic and mosaic as people are talking about it to be. You know, it's not that unusually structured, even with what I had said earlier about it.
Mm-hmm. Even by the standards of a movie with time shifting, there is just like, it's not that hard to grasp, you know?
Yeah, but I think some of that sense comes from their feeling of timelessness that, you know, very, you know, the second scene, I guess, once they pass through the Shimmer is them waking up and all saying that they don't know how long they've been there and recounting their food. And that is, that's another thing that I really like. I mean, that those ideas of kind of losing your frame of reference like that entirely and, you know, reading over your notes, memento style to remember where you are and what you're doing, you know, those are elements that, that really appealed to me, but it still has that, linear sense of, you know, them trying to make it to this MacGuffin and then fading away one by one.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Do you have any reading on, the Shimmer as just a concept, as a, sort of a giant metaphorical biodome?
No, I mean, no one that I think is what I think has to be the reading of it. I think, as I said, there are moments where I do come back to liking this movie throughout, and something like that, something that is so big and vague and unique. You know, I saw people talking about how this novel is unfilmable, and I don't know. I mean, I haven't read the books or anything, so I can't speak to what it is exactly, but I can see how this would be a daunting task, and mm-hmm. the depiction of the Shimmer, I think, is something that can look really bad, and I don't think it does. And so I think that's one thing I like about it, but also just that it is one of those big, you know, you call it a big, vague, metaphorical biodome, and, you know, that's what it is. It's so easy to attach a lot of things to it. And when I asked how this fits into sci-fi and what I thought about this as a movie in that genre, those are often movies about what technology is doing to us or what us and technology are doing to the environment, and that this is such a, you know, for the most part, one setting movie, and that the location of it and the Shimmer itself is so integral to the plot. It just seemed like there might be an environmentalism notion to that. And I don't think it's overly present, but I think it's one that you can still think about, and how quickly things change in this movie, just that notion of distortion and reproduction and evolution and things changing as they duplicate and things like that, I think tie into some of those biological elements as well. But it's a short line to draw to technology too. So I think in those broad strokes, I think the Shimmer is just vague enough that you can bring anything to it. And I don't have a particular one that has been most enjoyable to stick to.
Gotcha. Have you read Sean Fennessy's take on the movie?
No.
Okay. So Sean Fennessy's a writer for The Ringer, who I appreciate a lot. This is just it's basically two paragraphs, so I'll just read the whole thing. It just ties in with your technology reading, point. Here's a theory. Annihilation is a take on how social media has distorted the way people present against the actual version of themselves. The Shimmer is a hazy, reflective invader that mutates how we see the self and our world, like Facebook or Twitter or Instagram. Social media. Look at how happy I am on vacation in Florida. Reality. I'm trapped in a swamp fighting a mutant alligator and my intestines are made of snake eels. Social media platforms obsess, damage, and eventually destroy, and we are overtaken by the alien personage, the invader, after we eventually detonate in the flames of a bad tweet. The survivors are absorbed by the Shimmer, accumulating new growths, in parentheses followers, and rendering humanity irretrievable. Oh, that was a great take. It's a good reading of the movie. It's not anything near what I came out of it thinking, but I thought it's all there, and I think it's really cool.
Yeah, and I think when you talk about looking at this movie in 15 years, and we've talked about how sometimes they're not happy accidents and that these ideas are just kind of floating around in culture, but how something that can end up seeming more timely and more up the moment as time passes, and that the effect of technology, the effect of social media when we look at this era is going to be such a transition. And if a movie that comes out now can play into those themes even vaguely, it just makes it look more prescient, giving it a better chance of being considered a classic.
Yeah, absolutely. I did personally have a different sort of reading of The Shimmer, and part of this ties into the fact that immediately after we see the title card, The Shimmer, you know, we see them walk in, and then we see the title card, The Shimmer, and then we get that brief scene of Lena having sex with I forget his name as well. I'll just call him Romilly because that's his character in Interstellar. You know, them just having an affair together, and I thought that was really cool. And immediately after the Lighthouse title card, you get a brief scene that is not in the Lighthouse or the Shimmer at all. And I thought that was really cool. And I didn't really think of this when they showed the Area X title card. I'm not sure what the first thing we see after that title card is, but my guess is it's not something that takes place in Area X. But the thing that I found interesting was before Lena goes into the Shimmer, that aforementioned scene where her inventress's office, we see her look at the Shimmer from afar, and you could see it reflecting in her eye, you know, and just the look of the Shimmer is something that looks very visually appealing from afar. And once these people get inside of it, it just starts messing with their head and nothing becomes clear anymore. So I sort of saw the Shimmer as something that, again, from afar or for a brief time, seems like something appealing and something worth participating in. But then you actually get inside it and you realize it's wreaking havoc on your head more than you ever could have anticipated. And so basically, I think the Shimmer is sort of a stand-in for Lena's affair. It's just something that seems like it's worth doing, but eventually we find out through Lena's facial expressions, I guess, because she doesn't really vocalize it, that she has regrets, you know. And I just sort of thought that everybody else probably has some sort of thing that in their life that looks appealing from afar, but then once you actually participate in it, you're like, oh shit, that was a bad idea.
Yeah, and we don't have to jump to the end fully now, but that that reading of it as regret, and you know, she gets to the end and has to face herself, and in Stalker, they get to the end and you kind of realize the dark secret about the room is that who you are is what causes this amount of unhappiness in you. And that's a tough realization. And, you know, the enemy in this is so many different things. They get lost and there's these animals coming after them and they start turning on each other predictably. And just that idea that the worst thing, even after all of that, is yourself and how you can treat yourself and the worst pessimistic view of humanity in that way.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and I sort of felt the same, I guess, now that we're talking about metaphorical structures or orbs or whatever. the lighthouse, I thought, was a cool choice of building for the... are we cool calling it a meteor to hit at the beginning of the movie?
yeah, I'm fine with that.
That seems like the most logical.
the MacGuffin ball.
The alien ballet dancer. So I just thought that was an interesting choice of structure because, you know, a lighthouse is there a lighthouse is designed to sort of be something on the shore that's calling ships into home. You know, it's supposed to be, it's a beacon of light to call you back from what may or may not be sort of treacherous waters that you're out there in. And I just thought that was really cool that it sort of worked as a stand-in for home in general, you know, and Kane is sort of dealing with the idea that maybe his metaphorical lighthouse has kind of been destroyed. He's sort of at odds with maybe it has been, maybe it hasn't been. He hasn't sort of made up his mind. At least that's my reading on him as a character. And so I just thought that all of these things happening in a lighthouse was, or the climactic stuff all happening in the lighthouse and the meteor hitting the lighthouse, I thought it was a really cool visual metaphor to choose.
Yeah, and... We know that both of, I mean, Kane is active military, it seems, active, he won't tell us, or her. Mm-hmm. And we know Lena has military experience, as she says, and we kind of see in some physical confrontations. And this notion of the lighthouse being, you know, having just this thing that exists to service other people, like, it's just this thing that's out there looking out for everybody. And they, Kane, in seemingly being... I guess not the tip of the spear, because this has been going on for a weird amount of time, I guess, in this world. But their role as kind of the first people to sacrifice themselves for the better of people around them. And she's very much a leader, along with Ventress.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And just to tie into my point about the shimmer, the first scene after we see the lighthouse title card is Kane and Lena just sitting on a couch reading together, you know, and they just say, hey, Kane says, hey, Lena says, hey, end of scene, you know, and that's like, that's just an absolute, like, perfect example of something that would just be a simple image of home that you might want to come back to, even though that home may or may not have been covered in trees and whatnot, as we see Lena not being able to bring herself to go upstairs or anything in the shimmer version of their own house. But yeah, I don't know. I just thought that was a cool choice of building, the lighthouse.
Yeah, and we see them together in the lighthouse and at home kind of throughout, and they both have what I'll understate as very meaningful encounters in the lighthouse by the end of the film, right?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. It's where it all happens, man. In the lighthouse. Mm-hmm. I mean, should we just talk about the ending? I feel like we've made it through the journey.
Yeah.
All right, well, what's your take on the doppelganger dance sequence?
I think it's a big swing for the fences that totally whiffs with me.
Oh, it's so good.
And I've heard people say that. I can't think of anything other than I love the idea of going big, and this one just kind of misses for me. I like a weird ending, having just read and watched 2001: A Space Odyssey recently. Mm-hmm. It's just one of more of those things I'm chalking up to just sounds great on paper and didn't, I was not engaged. And that's, again, like most kind of swing for the fences. If you're not hooked, it can be long. And I think that you can be engaged in the 10-minute interpretive dance or you can't be. And it was just one more thing that I thought just didn't hook me.
Okay, what about the stuff where Ventress is giving her final lines, says annihilation, and then kind of explodes, like before they get back up to the ground level, before the dance sequence actually begins?
Again, I think visually cool, but I just was not invested enough with that for it to hit too hard emotionally.
Okay.
I assume you're on the other side of this.
I mean, hit hard emotionally is a different sort of thing. Like,
right.
I can't feel like I was like invested in Lena's emotional journey in that moment, but I was like, holy shit, this is new. This is something I've said probably on 308 of our 309 podcasts is, if I see something new in a movie that's even like mildly interesting to me, it immediately becomes my new favorite thing in the world. Just because it is, when you've watched so many movies and so many, again, my tastes always skew pretty, you know, like I don't have particularly adventurous views or tastes. It's mostly Hollywood related. And this is a Hollywood movie where something really weird happens in. And if you give me a sequence like that in a movie that I'm already kind of invested in, I'm immediately going to just be like, this is perfect. I love this. It's super loud and sounds super weird. And you could go on for another 45 minutes and I'd probably still be okay with it. You know?
Yeah.
But I enjoyed the sequence. I thought it was good. And I think, you know, it leads to, without that sequence, I don't think the question of the ending is anywhere near as enjoyable. I mean, obviously something would have to happen in the lighthouse. She couldn't just go there, look in the hole and be like, oh, there's nothing. Cool. Going home. You know, like that would be way worse, obviously, even to you, I think you would agree. But I don't know. I enjoy it in the moment. And I think what it leads to with the question at the end, I think is cool to me.
Yeah. So do you mean the question at the end being if they are the same people as when they went in, or something kind of more abstract than that?
No, it's mostly just that. Are they the same people? Who is either of them the doppelganger, or is either of them the same person that we've been following through the whole movie? Because in reading about this movie, I've read a lot of what happens next in the story of the books, none of which I cared about or thought about when I was watching this movie. Again, my way into these movies is always to find something that relates to a human being, not something that relates to plot. Even if, again, as we said, the emotional hooks of this movie are very weak. I guess my skin's just very thin, so it's easy to hook me with these things. But like, yeah, the plot mechanics don't matter as much to me. I don't care if there's like a forthcoming alien invasion or anything. I just care about where Lena and Kane are at the end of the movie, I guess. And I thought that stuff was interesting. So I guess the first question is, and I can give you my answer. Do you think either of them is a doppelganger, both, or mix and match? I think Kane is pretty clearly the doppelganger, and Lena is still Lena. Thoughts?
Yes, I think that I think they're both the doppelganger now, and I think that I don't know. I mean, I just think about this against an ending like Inception, right? Where there's this idea that it's a similar question, right? That's a fair comparison.
I have very complicated feelings about the ending of Inception, so
okay, that's right.
I can't immediately say yes.
Okay, so I'll just
they both end with a question for sure,
right? And they both end in kind of it has the fundamental nature of the person you've spent this whole movie with, pretty much, one way or the other. Or, you know, there's kind of two ways. Yeah, as you said, there's a question. There's one thing, or there's two realities, and you have to pick one, mm-hmm. Which broadly is kind of the end of these. And I think that, I think the glint in her eye just makes it clear that she is. And yeah, as you said, I think it's obvious that he is too. And I think that they're both the doppelgangers in this movie kind of makes it seem like there's a more ambiguous, thought-provoking question mark at the end, when I think it looks like it's an answer dressed up as a question for me.
Okay. So the way that I see it is, and for one, I totally understand where you're coming from with that. but as we have discussed, I'm just more attached to this movie. So probably just put more thought into it. And so my thinking about that is You know, Kane was conflicted about, Kane knew about the affair. He's feeling conflicted about Lena, certainly conflicted enough to volunteer for a mission that he's probably going to die on. And so when he got to the lighthouse, you know, he just sort of, that version of himself just, it didn't have the strength to come back or anything, you know? So he uses the phosphorus grenade and kills himself, and the doppelganger comes back, right? He just feels that he can't fully come back from that betrayal. Whereas Lena, her dance with the doppelganger, I sort of view that as her destroying the destructive quality of herself, you know, like, because once that grenade gets pulled and real Lena runs out of the lighthouse and doppelganger Lena starts being set on fire, she turns to Kane, touches his corpse, sets him on fire, and then burns down the lighthouse, you know? So I think that's meant to indicate that Lena, this is Lena being destructive. This is Lena burning down the lighthouse that is her marriage. It's the Lena that saw the shimmer and thought, hey, it's worth having an affair with that guy from Interstellar. And I feel like the idea is that Lena comes back without that, that in her. She's still affected by having been in the shimmer, you know, because that's not something that you can, you know, control Z out of, you know. And just like the doppelganger of Kane has been so affected, like, he can come back, but he is also a totally changed version as well. And he'll never be able to have the same sort of conversations with his wife again. Like, they can still be together, but both of them are changed forever by the actions that that I suppose mostly Lena, but that they would both have partaken in, you know?
So I was gonna ask if you're reading about this as looking at it with regret and through that lens of the relationship she's had with other people, that to see that she, you know, she has that in her eye at the end, that she's fundamentally changed, that part of regret is that the damage has been done and it can never be undone. I mean, you kind of move past it in a way, but it's never undone.
Yeah, is exactly. You're still the person that had the capability to do this to the person you love the most in your life, you know? And it's going to take a while to get back to a point where you guys are comfortable having a tickle fight together, you know?
Yeah, and Lena bests that worst version of herself, the one she kind of, that's her, but she doesn't seem to recognize as her for a while. She's, as I said, bested that part of her and can move on in a less destructive manner.
Yes, yeah, exactly. Like, she has at least learned from this sort of destructive bone that was in her body, you know, and you know, she knows it was a mistake and hopefully wouldn't do it again, but she also knows that she has affected her life in a way that she can't come back from, you know. And I think the thing that is meant to be a giveaway between or at least it certainly supports my point, so I'm sort of taking it as a clue that Lena and that Kane is a doppelganger, because if he sips the water, he bleeds into it. When Lena sips the water glass in the interview, she doesn't, and we get that fantastic shot of the water separating in the glass as well. And I just sort of think that's meant to be our clue to sort of signify that the real Lena came back. Yeah, just again, permanently affected by her own actions. You know, like, again, these are the shimmer and the lighthouse I view strongly as metaphors for her own actions. You know,
yeah, no, that works for sure.
Cool. So we'll end on a sure, I guess. You know, one of us really liked this movie, the other didn't. Maybe in 15 years we'll catch up. catch up with the rest of us.
Check in 15 years.
Yeah, exactly. When we'll probably still be doing this podcast. So thanks for listening to the MacGuffin Men, and be sure to check back in 15 years for our next episode.